You're listening to the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Slavery, it's not just part of the past. 150 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, slavery still exists in the form of coercing people into sexual servitude or industrial or agricultural work with little or no pay. North Carolina ranks 10th in the nation for its trafficking numbers. Nonprofits in eastern North Carolina are trying to prevent these abuses from happening by raising awareness and calling on state legislators for stricter laws. Restore One, an organization based in Greenville, is specifically helping teenage boys ages 12 to 17 by providing a safe place where they can receive long-term restoration. Executive Director and founder of Restore One, Anna Smith, says Wilmington, Greenville, and Jacksonville are major hubs for trafficking in the eastern part of the state.
Because we have a beautiful coastline, we attract people from all over the nation and also from all over the world. It's a huge tourist attraction. And unfortunately, when we have a large tourist population coming into our state, sometimes they come with the intent to buy sex.
In addition to tourism, Smith says labor trafficking among the agricultural community is another problem here. Major thoroughfares such as I-85, US 64, and Highway 70 are used to transport victims throughout North Carolina. In sex trafficking, victims are controlled by a third party that could be a family member, a predator, or someone posing as a friend that is absorbing the profit. Sarah Tellis is the executive director of the Pearl Ministry in New Bern, a nonprofit working to prevent human trafficking and restoring victims. Tellis shares the story of a teenaged New Bern girl that almost fell prey to a trafficker's deceptive methods last fall.
This young girl posted pictures on social media websites that made her very vulnerable. She was actually approached by a man on the internet that appeared to want to become her boyfriend, which is very common. That's very typical about what happens. And we were able to actually intercede on this case and give some education to the adults that were interacting with her. And this girl actually got away from her trafficker, and he was made to leave the area.
A common misconception is that trafficking only involves young girls. However, a growing number of young males in Greenville are not only involved in sex trafficking, but sexual exploitation.
Boys are often tagged on to the end of a sentence, the end of a study, or the end of a lecture saying, oh, it happens to boys too.
It's hard to put a number on exactly how many boys it affects because their minor status. But last September, a former Boy Scout leader from Greenville was arrested and sentenced to 6 months in prison for two counts of third-degree sexual exploitation of a minor. Also last year, a Bertie County man was charged with 50 counts of sexual exploitation of minors after his child pornography stash was discovered. Smith says sexual exploitation takes on many different faces.
Say if you have a child who comes home from school and their family does not have the means to provide them with food for dinner. And so they have a man or a woman meet them in their community and say, if you give me some sort of sexual favor, I will buy you dinner. Now that's sexual exploitation.
It's a common problem not only in Greenville, but the entire country. Smith says an estimated 300,000 youth are sexually exploited every day in the United States.
And so what we found is these boys are resulting to sexual exploitation to meet their needs. And so we're seeing a growing number of boys going into the sex trade because of starting from those very reasons.
When a female is rescued from sex trafficking, there are a number of organizations that can offer rehabilitation. However, there's no place yet for male victims.
I read a study not too long ago, and it spoke of a sting operation that rescued boys and girls who are sex trafficked in America. And there were 6 boys rescued. There was a statement that said there were no services available for these boys. There was no shelter placement for them. And they did not know what happened to the boys after the sting.
Restore One in Greenville is hoping to change that by opening Anchor House, the nation's first long-term restorative home for adolescent boys.
And so what we'll do is we'll provide everything that a boy would need. Counseling, we'll provide the education, life skills training, recreation. And so our hope is our shelter will be the first of many for boys.
Smith says it's likely male human trafficking victims from other states would receive care at Anchor House. Next month, Restore One will launch its Give for One campaign that will raise money to buy a facility in Greenville that will house boys. The organization is also in the process of lining up counselors and other staff members that will work with the boys when they arrive.
And when they exit, it is our job to make sure that they are placed in a safe and stable environment that will continue to grow and foster the skills they have learned, the skills they have recovered while in our program.
The Anchor House isn't set to open until 2014, but Smith says they will continue to raise awareness about the issue of human trafficking. Restore One and Pearl Ministry held a prayer vigil in Raleigh on Wednesday, advocating a bill working its way through the House that would require convicted sex traffickers to register with the Sex Offender Registry. It passed the Senate with a vote of 50-0 earlier this month. On April 29th, both organizations will present to the General Assembly an appeal to continue to address the issue of human trafficking in North Carolina. Director of Pearl Ministry, Sarah Tellis.
And we're hoping to bring that issue to light in a deeper way by showing the movie Nefarious with them and also having speakers that have experience in transforming laws in other states give their testimony about how North Carolina can improve the laws that are on the books now to fight against human trafficking.
The local government is also getting involved in combating human trafficking. Pitt County hired a full-time detective through a Department of Justice grant to investigate human trafficking cases that occur in the county.
I think until we create a community that is intolerant to trafficking, then of course trafficking is going to take place. But when the community won't tolerate it anymore and gets behind these endeavors, then we will create an atmosphere that doesn't allow for it to happen.
You're listening to the Down East Journal. Think about something very simple. Imagine you're moving to a different place, and in the move, you lose something, like a couple of shower rings. Well, imagine instead of having to go to the store or ordering the rings from a manufacturer, you just go to your computer and design one, or simply download a model, and print them out. East Carolina University in Greenville has 5 3D printers on campus, and we went there to find out what they're being used for and exactly how they work. Stephen O'Connell has this.
Go online and you'll find all sorts of fantastic ideas to demonstrate the potential of 3D printing, from a lunar base to the perfect shoe for your foot to food, and even printing a 3D printer using a 3D printer. At many colleges, they're experiencing a more modest use, developing prototypes or models for students and manufacturers. I went to East Carolina University last week and spoke with two professors responsible for 3D printers on campus. Professor Ranjit Agarwala, who is studying for a PhD right now, told me that he uses the 3D printer for students in his engineering and technology classes and has done some work for national companies that manufacture in North Carolina.
For example, a couple of years back, Cahen and Tarbro, they manufacture computers for Honda. That come down and ask us to make a computer casing for them.
A 3D printer's technical and less fantastic term is a rapid prototyping machine. Professor Agarwala tells me at the beginning of our interview that Dr. Rick Williams was the horse or white knight who got the machines on campus. Williams has been working with the printers for the past 10 years, including time at Auburn University in Alabama. He has a box of gadgets and trinkets with him, including a wrench, a turbine blade, and brackets he uses for resistance tests in his classes.
So the tolerances aren't that great, so the wrench itself, although it's functional, you can see it doesn't necessarily move back and forth real smoothly.
The black wrench is made from ABC plastic, the same used to make Legos. The high-resistance plastic is shipped to them in string form, in spools, like a knitting ball.
But essentially what happens is this machine melts the plastic and it runs through an extrusion nozzle that extrudes it down about 0.001 of an inch in diameter, and it prints almost like a glue gun, one layer at a time.
For the name given, the printing process isn't rapid. The newest wrench has been printing for an hour when we get to the shop, and Dr. Williams says it will be a half hour more. Although fully assembled when printed, there's another disadvantage, most especially for the aesthetically minded engineer.
You see on this little model here, because you get layers, you end up getting this called stair-stepping that occurs. So anytime you have a curved surface, it's not going to be perfectly smooth.
Despite some obvious disadvantages, the opportunities the technology affords are striking, and the downsides are easily dismissed. 3D printing uses materials that are recyclable and cheaper because it's built from scratch, so material is not wasted. But when it comes to the price of the printing machines, figures vary widely. A home version about the size of a toaster can be purchased for $2,000. The machines that Dr. Williams and Professor Agarwala use are in the $50,000 range. And as Dr. Williams told me, the prices don't slow there.
There are machines out there that are upwards of $1 million that the military uses to a lot of repair parts. They can do titanium repair turbine blades, basically using lasers and titanium powders.
After watching the wrench print for a few minutes longer, Professor Agarwala takes us to the shop where the machine he operates is. This machine resembles an incubator. It shuffles a powder back and forth on a surface. On top, you see a colored outline. The object is being printed underneath.
So what it does, it takes this 3D CAD model, okay, in color. So what you're seeing right now is actually this layer being printed, all right? And you can see, if you come here, you see how that is laying a glue, okay, laying the powder, and then injecting that glue on top of it. You see that? The color, and then putting another layer.
This machine manufactures an object with considerable more detail and color. The trade-off for the beauty and detail of these objects is that they are usually not functional. The engine model and the Cleopatra head he gives me are virtually useless. And as opposed to the plastic's almost instant readiness, this machine's post-processing requires more time. As Williams put it, the object becomes something of an archaeological dig when completed. Professor Agarwala finishes it with a super glue material which strengthens it. Despite the two machines' differences, they operate off the same principle. Dr. Williams and Professor Agarwala agree that most satisfying is its ability to help their students.
A lot of my students, actually three or four of them, are in jobs that their job profile is just printing, using the 3D printer, you know, for electronic industry or something like that. So I get a kick out of it to see that, you know, what they're actually learning in the class, they're actually earning a living out of.
Professor Agarwala has one student who is attempting to build a 3D printer from scratch. He's using off-the-shelf products, and Agarwala says the student's ambition is to have one in a home for $500. Dr. Williams is excited about its power to make ideas something you can hold.
Yeah, I think similar to Ranjit, it's seeing a student where they'll design something CAD, and I think a lot of times when you're in the CAD environment, it's hard to see scale. You can zoom in, make it as big as you want, make it really small, and the picture's worth 1,000 words, but I think then if you have, 3D models worth 1,000 pictures.
When I asked about students' access to the machines, Williams says students aren't trained to operate them. And although it would only take a few minutes, he says what's important is mastering the computer-aided design or CAD software. Williams says he doesn't use the printer very often because they don't have the manpower to do so. While they both seem to agree that a lack of resources was one of the biggest problems in utilizing the technology to its fullest, I sensed an underlying issue, one that is unfortunate right now but exciting for the future. I sensed that maybe they don't really know what to do with the machine. But as you'll see, very soon, 3D printers may be building homes, even a lunar base, constructing firearms, engineering body tissue, reconstructing evidence for police investigations, and rebuilding artifacts for archaeologists. Stephen O'Connell, Public Radio East.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent. with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Although things have gotten chilly again for the rest of this week, soon we'll be starting to see ground nesting bees flying about. These are the type that you see along the surface of the soil, and it looks like swarms because there might be many of them. But in fact, these are most likely solitary bees that dig in the soil, foraging for food and seeking out new nesting sites. There's not really a true colony of these bees. They're each individuals that live in a vertical tunnel they've dug in the soil. They make small side chambers where they provision pollen for their offspring. What looks like swarming of these bees around the soil surface are usually males getting together with females. The bees make small mounds in the soil sometimes, each made by an individual queen, which does all of the work herself, with no workers to help. Although the holes and small mounds in the soil might be unsightly, especially where there are large numbers, it's mostly a cosmetic issue. The bigger problem is that people walking by may panic because they assume that these are swarms of stinging-type bees that are likely to attack if they get too close to their nest. However, these turf-nesting bees rarely do sting, even though they can. These solitary bees are beneficial and should be left alone if possible. If these solitary bees do try to nest in a sandbox or an area where there are many children who are hypersensitive to stings, you may want to try covering the area with a tarp during the day. It might take a few weeks to deter most of the bees, but they'll find somewhere else to go. If tarping doesn't work, you can saturate wide areas with soapy water to bring the bees out. Soap will work somewhat as an insecticide and may kill some of the bees, but many of them will simply leave the area and find somewhere else to go. Hopefully, it will be warm enough soon for these solitary bees and other beneficial insects to get started for the spring. Watch out for them. It will give you an idea that the warm weather really is approaching. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
A popular folk legend and popular folk song is now told in a piece of historical fiction authored by a Wilkes County resident. George Olson has this, which originally aired in December 2011.
Most people with any knowledge of folklore are familiar with the following.
Thomas C. Dooley, not having the fear of God before his eyes, but being moved and seduced by the instigations of the devil, did willfully, feloniously, and of malice aforethought, make an assault upon one Laura Foster.
Though not as familiar as they are with that same story told via a different medium.
When the sun rises tomorrow, Tom Dooley must hang. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poor boy, you're bound to die.
The Kingston Trio performing The Ballad of Tom Dooley. It was a number one single for the folk group back in 1958. Not bad for a song that had been written about 90 years earlier in the wake of Tom Dooley's 1868 conviction for the murder 2 years earlier of his lover Laura Foster in Wilkes County. The song was first heard about the time of Tom's death by hanging following his conviction, and perhaps heard by the song's namesake as he went to the gallows.
I actually have no proof of that. I don't think there's anything that can prove that that did not happen, but it is something that has been discussed for many, many years. And he was a musician and played the fiddle, had plenty of time while he was in the jail to write a ballad. And many people still say that he did write his own ballad.
Kieran Wheeling Reynolds of Elkville in Wilkes County, the author of Tom Dooley, the story behind the ballad. It's a second act for the book. Reynolds' first interaction with the story came when she wrote the play Tom Dooley, a Wilkes County legend, which has received annual performances by the Wilkes Playmakers for the past 12 years. Much of the book is like that protestation. There's no proof something didn't happen. Reynolds refers to the book as historical fiction and admits to a certain artistic license with events, though it's not license that others haven't taken. For instance, the tale told of Tom Dooley is that the murder of Laura Foster was the culmination of events that occurred after Tom returned from the Civil War to find his lover Ann Melton married to another man. Dramatic, just not true.
One thing that I've always heard was that Tom went away to war, and then Ann married James Melton for his money while Tom was away. But Ann Melton actually married James Melton before Tom went away to war. Again, for the same reasons. She married him, you know, for security, for money, to get away from home, and Tom maybe wasn't the best marriage material.
So in order to present a better story and stay true to the ballad which most people know the Tom Dooley story from, Tom returns from the Civil War to find his one true love married to another man. And Ann Melton's mother, Lottie, is the hand that put the ultimate murder of Laura Foster in motion as she broke off communications between her daughter and Tom Dooley, in this scene away from his home to fight for the Confederacy, in order to facilitate security for their family by marrying Ann to the comparatively wealthy James Melton.
Miss Foster, Calvin Coles told me to bring this to you. It came on the mail pony this morning. He says it's for Ann. Lottie glared at the little intruder. It's from the war, Miss Foster. Calvin says it's probably from Tom Dooley. Old Calvin says Tom Dooley's a regular war hero now. He says... Lottie raised her hand and stopped the boy in mid-sentence. Well, thank you for your time. I'll see to it that Ann gets it. You give my best to Mr. Coles. Excited, the boy ignored her and continued. Calvin says he'll read it for Ann if he wants. Lottie Foster turned on the boy. I said I'll see to it that Ann gets it. Now thank you for your time, she snapped. Lottie made her way back to the porch and watched until the foolish boy was out of sight. She was tired of being hungry. She was tired of being worn out all the time. She was tired of sewing for people all hours of the day and tired of entertaining men she didn't like all hours of the night. Lottie knew that chances like this one with James were few and far between. The chance of a lifetime had just fallen into her lap, and she didn't intend for her family to lose it. I won't let you ruin this for us, Tom Dooley, she murmured to herself. My daughter can do better than you. Lottie Foster tore the letter to shreds and burned it in the wood stove.
It's the moment in the book where one can see the situation start to devolve, but with Ann actually married to James Melton before Tom left for the Civil War, it couldn't have happened. Or perhaps we should say we can't prove it didn't. If you read Tom Dooley, the story behind the ballad, you might get an impression about who Karen Wheeling Reynolds believes was guilty of Laura Foster's murder. But her book doesn't lay guilt at any one person's feet. Several people are presented as possibilities, including Tom Dooley, but without anyone's guilt or innocence confirmed.
You know, I'm also an actress, and we learn in acting classes, one of the first things they'll tell you, and it's the same thing I believe in writing, is don't presume that your audience is stupid. They get it. And I think that for me to try to force something on them and say, this is true, this is the way it happened, and particularly in a case like this, would be wrong.
One thing that makes the case particularly hard to decipher is the case is a four-sided love triangle. It wasn't just Tom Dooley and his longtime lover Ann Melton and his newly pregnant and soon-to-be wife Laura Foster. There was a fourth person in the mix who became the prosecution's star witness against Tom Dooley, despite problems with her own credibility.
Pearline Foster is such a wild card in all of this. She worked for the Meltons. She loved Tom Dooley. You know, there were many people that documented that she really cared for him, and he did not return her affections. And she became so bitter. She turned state's evidence, but she told so many things during the trial. She accused Ann Melton of killing Laura, and Pearline even implicated herself. She got up and she said, and direct from Celia Scott's testimony, she said, if I hang Ann Melton, you will too. You're as deep in the mud as I am in the mire.
It's events such as that which has kept the question of Tom's guilt or innocence alive for nearly 150 years. There's even conflicting words from Tom Dooley himself. On the gallows, he professed his innocence, but the day before wrote that he was the only person who had a hand in Laura Foster's murder. Which was true? Did Tom Dooley rightly go to the gallows, or was his confession just a ploy to protect his true love? Those questions bring up one other aspect that partly explains why the story remains fascinating after all these years. It's not just a murder taking place amid salacious circumstances.
I do think it is a love story, and, you know, people sometimes, what they want, they go about it the wrong way to get what they want, and I think this is a classic example of that. I think there's no question that Tom Dula and Ann Melton loved each other, and they had strong ties that began at a very young age.
Karen Wheeling Reynolds and the Wilkes Playmakers presented the courtroom scenes from her play, Tom Dooley, a Wilkes County Legend, to the State Supreme Court Society of Historians back in 2002. They ruled Tom Dooley not guilty.
This time tomorrow, reckon where I'll be. Down in some lonesome valley, hanging from a white oak tree.
Karen Wheeling Reynolds is the author of Tom Dooley, The Story Behind the Ballad, published by Little Creek Books. I'm George Olson.